This is a special time of the year for sure. But now we get to Epiphany Sunday. Tomorrow is the real day, but here we are on Epiphany Sunday. And for most people, the season of gift giving is over. The sea of presents from Christmas have been mostly put away, and decorative trees and lights are coming down, and so large in a little bit. And New Year's Eve has come and gone, and people now resume their normal activity in their lives. And now selling of Christmas gifts in the store. Now you go to the store and they're focused on St. Valentine's Day. The thrill of the holiday season has passed. And for most, Epiphany just doesn't have the same zing that Christmas did. In fact, even in Jesus' day, Epiphany happened at a much later date than probably we imagine. But most likely visiting the Bethlehem household sometimes in Jesus' first or second year of life, the initial Gloria in Excelsis Deo. I love that when we sing that. Thanks, Greg and Janie for leading us through those wonderful hymns and songs. Glory to God in the highest is what it means. So in the case of Mary and Joseph, maybe their initial fear of discovery has already passed, and things at Joseph's household has gotten pretty much back on track. They were at, Joseph was, his hometown was Bethlehem, and Mary was in Nazareth, and when they got together, that's why they left Nazareth to go to Bethlehem for the census and for the taxes. So Joseph's family had a house there in Bethlehem. But sometime in the first year of their marriage, maybe Joseph managed to build them a home, or at least in the tradition of the Middle Eastern countries, they start a house and then they build onto it as they get married and kids come and all that. Just a wonderful thing how they built their homestead. So by the time the Magi have arrived at the house, somewhere east of Israel, young Jesus was most likely somewhere between 9 months and 2 years old. They find him there with Mary, his mother, in a serious sit-down with the family. Now, when most of us hear the passage, as we do each and every year, we like to think about the stories and focus on the gifts. And let's face it, gold, gifts of gold and frankincense and myrrh fascinate us. But they were given to them for a reason and a purpose, which is a message for another time. And yet we think about it, in the dwelling of these physical treasures, we miss the far greater gift that the Magi have offered, the gift of warning. Herod's coming to get you. The Magi were no fool. They were considered the wise men. They caught on to Herod's underhanded plot pretty much right away. Well, they are the Magi, you know, the wise men. They were wise to Herod's motives, as a farmer to a fox. Not only that, they had been alerted in a dream by God not to report to Herod. So after warning the family of Herod's ear, they left for their country by another route, returning and then refusing to return to Jerusalem. They gave the family well-needed a lead, heads up, if you would, to get out of town before Herod discovered that the Magi wasn't coming back to him. Fortunately, Herod, we learn, is a fairly lazy, cowardly character. Jesus would call his son the same thing later on. And maybe a little bit crazy, maybe a little bit nuts, but that's what he was. And typically, he substitutes violence for strategy or maybe even smarts. So instead of seeking out Jesus on his own, he makes a sweeping decree that all children 2 years and younger in that region of Bethlehem should be eradicated or killed, so that no chance of a Messiah or future king surviving could be ensured. He wanted to protect his authority and him being king. After all, he was the king of the Jews. Now, Herod was petrified of losing power, even assassinating members of his own family, you might remember, in order to protect his throne. Fortunately, again, by this time, the decree was eradicated. Joseph and his family had fled into Egypt, most likely settled in a little town called Alexandria, until the end of Herod's rule, which was approximately a year or two later. So after Herod's death, still worried about the chaos under the Herod's son, Archelaus, who was also wanted power, Joseph opted to take his family and relatives to Nazareth rather than going back to his home in Bethlehem. There they would build a life together, sort of like under the radar, until Jesus became of age. Have we ever wondered maybe why Jesus loved children so much? How sad it must have been for him to know of the death of mostly 40, 50 young people who were slaughtered by Herod in what we now call the Massacre of the Innocents. Jesus, the Lord of life, who would offer the salvation gift of life to all who would turn to God, was given the first gift of life in a warning by a group of magi many years before. Without the magi's greatest gift, their warning about Herod and Jesus' life and ministry would have never happened. It's amazing the way God works to guide, warm, and solicit assistance even from those who aren't Christian yet. It's also amazing how hard God tries to reach us to the extent in which will God go to try to help us circumvent the bad decisions in life, the evils, the dark intents of other people. It takes a community to raise a child. And we know this from experience. Fostering faith takes community involvement. That's why we come together in an act of fellowship in what we call the church. It's an act of fellowship. It's a commitment. It's a lot of love that takes place in the community to ward off evil and to protect the most innocent and vulnerable citizens. But for Mary and Joseph that day, the Magi served as their community. They didn't need to be Jewish. They didn't need to hail from Jerusalem. They didn't need to be circumcised, ordained, or even part of the family. They only needed to be sent by God to do a caring thing. For God sent his Son into the world to save all people and all those who would be wise enough to honor God with the goodness of their hearts. For it's the loving quality of our hearts that God has wanted all along. And make no mistake, Jesus' greatest gift in his young life came not from his fellow Jewish people, not from the rulers of his land, and not from his own citizens, but from a group of foreigners from another country whose compassion, wisdom, honor, and heart would supersede anything legal, political, providential, or traditional in the surroundings of Jesus' birth. That's what it means to be true community with one another. Community is not about a region or a background or an association or a heritage. It's not about the boundaries, ethnicities, or even religious identity. It's about being human. In a world that has grown far too inhumane. It's about forging connections that go far deeper than artificial or cultural divisions. It's about caring about each other and doing the right thing even when the rest of the world seems to be intent on going the other way. Communities foster love. Communities take courage. And from the beginning of its inception, the church, the called out ones, we are here, was conceived as an alternative community. We are a community of believers, a model for the rest of the world, a place in which those persecuted by others can come and find safety and sanctuary. That's why we call this the sanctuary. It's a place to come to be safe, a sanctuary, in a place which even those who fail can be given another chance. After all, the church is a hospital for sinners. The church, by its very nature, is a countercultural entity, loyal to God and fostering of humanity. So when the church can break free of cultural and regional influences toward divisions and power and status agendas, it can become capable of giving the greatest gift, gift that nurtures people's hearts and lives, and they care for those threatened, that offer wisdom in the face of hate and division, that change lives in a courageous and unselfish way. Seed planters, helping one another, not only in a financial sense, but in a physical sense, or more importantly, in a spiritual sense. So the church today must stand up and be courageous in a world of cowardly persecution of others. It must offer the guiding light of Christ to those struggling in darkness with no direction or foundation. I always think about that gospel song that's really blessed me a lot. It's called The Lighthouse. Where would we be without that lighthouse? The church must guide like a divine shepherd through the confusing forest of messages that would seek to divine, kill, and see us all as different. I like what Alveda King said. You know, we bleed one blood. She was Martin Luther King's niece. And you really do the history on that family and really do a lot of digging into what Martin Luther was all about. He was by far not a very, he was not a perfect type of preacher. I can't let it go with that. But the love that they shared and the love that he was trying to share in the area of what was going on with civil rights and different things. That's what made the Church of Jesus Christ most fond about community, about covenant with God and love towards all people and all humanity. So that God's guidance can reign and the world can change. For when everything in this world seems to be so crazy, Christ's wisdom. Where did Solomon get that wisdom? He got it from God. You know, Solomon came into the world with a silver spoon or a gold spoon in his mouth. He didn't need anything. And when God asked him, "What can I do for you, Solomon?" He said, "Well, I don't really need anything, but what I'd like to have is wisdom." And God granted him wisdom. Now, Solomon failed at exercising a lot of that wisdom. That's why he felt so compelled to share the wisdom that God has given him in the little book of Proverbs, and more importantly, the book of Ecclesiastes. It's an amazing book. So the wisdom of Christ is love. And the love of Christ always leads to life. The Word, Jesus, manifested in the flesh, comes to live among us. The Word, Jesus, is the way to life and how we can have life more abundantly.